Those of you who have been teaching in other classes and have joined the class this quarter will remind you the lessons are on the back. I have made a few that start at chapter 1 and go all the way through. But also, if you have, you know, wanted to, if you picked up one of the others, you didn't necessarily want to go back and get chapters 1 through 7. The 8 through 15 is back there. And the chapter contents are on a separate page. So, because you want those, they're not in that material. Also, one other thing I will just say, on the website, you can find all the questions, chapters 1 through 15. And as we go along, I'll be updating that. Chapter 1, Ascension and Matthias replaces Judas. Chapter 2 is Pentecost. Chapter 3, Lame Man Healed and Second Sermon. All right, chapter 4. Peter and John are arrested. Chapter 5. Yes, Ananias and Sapphira and all the apostles are arrested. Chapter 6. Seven chosen to serve. We're getting this. Chapter 7. Stephen's speech and his death. And chapter 8 opens with church being scattered. And then Philip preaches in Samaria and to the eunuch. Chapter 9, conversion of Saul and story of Dorcas. Chapter 10, conversion of Cornelius, the first Gentile. Chapter 11, Peter explains Cornelius and the gospel spreads to Antioch. Chapter 12, death of James and Peter's delivered. James is killed, Peter's delivered. Chapter 13, first journey begins in two places. Get them in order. Cyprus and Antioch. All right. Then chapter 14, first journey ends. Lystra, Iconium and Lystra. And then chapter 15, discussion of circumcision at Jerusalem. And then chapter 16, second journey, Philippi. All right. Not bad. Got to work a little bit ragged there toward the end, but we'll get there. All right. Let's look at chapter 13. Continue that study tonight. And in chapter 13, we've got that, as we said, the first journey begins. And the first journey begins from what city? Antioch. It begins up here at Antioch. Let's see if we can trace it real quick. I know you can't cheat by reading those words. He goes from Antioch. They catch the boat in what city? Seleucia. They sail from Seleucia to the island of Cyprus. First place mentioned they preached is Salamis. They work their way across the island to Paphos, tomato, tomato, you know, P-A-P-H-O-S, whichever, however you say it. They went there. From there they sailed up to Perga in Pamphylia. And then from there they go to another Antioch of Pisidia this time. Now, just to real quickly, on the island of Cyprus, who was the notable enemy of the gospel there? Bar-Jesus, who's also called Elymas. And he was said to be a sorcerer and a false prophet. And what ended up happening to him? He went blind for a season, or he was caused to be blind for a season. Who was the notable man that believed on the Lord? Sergius Paulus. And whose name was changed about that time? Saul became Paul. As I said Sunday, it's just so interesting how Luke tells that. Saul, who is also called Paul, And then from then on, he's Paul, without any explanation of why that name was given. It may have always been a name, and he just started going by that. It could have been taken from Sergius Paulus. We just don't know, because that's not what mattered. But they leave Cyprus and they came up to Perga. And we were talking Sunday, no mention of preaching there, but something very significant happened there. And what was that? John Mark turned back and went back to Jerusalem, and that will come into the story later. Are there any questions or leftover comments from what we covered Sunday about Cyprus and the beginning of the journey? All right, look at 13 through 15. We talked a little about this. Just say a couple of words and then move on. But it says, now when Paul and his party, isn't that a change? From Barnabas and Saul, it's Paul and his party. He is definitely the leader at this point. Now when Paul and his party set sail from Paphos, they came to Perga and Pamphylia, and John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. But when they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. And after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them saying, men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. So here we find them. We talked about John Mark leaving. On the Sabbath, they go where? Synagogue. And what is the synagogue? It was kind of like Jewish church. That's the place the Jews would gather on the Sabbath for the reading of the law and the prophets and, exhortation. It's not a miniature temple. Don't confuse it with a temple where sacrifices are offered and such. But it was a place of prayer and the study of the word, the law. And they come in there. And based on what we can read from the first century Jewish writings, they divided the law, which to them the law was Genesis through Deuteronomy. And the prophets covered a whole lot of books that we wouldn't include in the prophets. The writings that were considered inspired, various ones. But they divided them into 54 readings. And you read a section each week. And so they've done the reading. And then, all along you have those things. And you have them in your own life, where you say something and then later you go, why did I ever say that? And I have a feeling the rulers of the synagogue had one of those later. They would go, why did we give these guys the opportunity to speak? But they ask Barnabas and Saul, if you've got any word of exhortation for the people, why don't you speak? Now, it's been suggested, it's highly unlikely that they just noticed two strangers and said, hey, y'all want to say something? They'd probably talk to them. You can imagine Saul may have said, in Jerusalem, I studied under Gamaliel. I don't know that for sure, but that would have certainly, made you look like a pretty good scholar there. But whatever the case, they said, do you have anything you want to say? Oh, what an opening. Then Paul stood up and motioning with his hand said, men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen. The God of this people Israel chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with an uplifted arm, he brought them out of it. Now for a time of about 40 years, he put up with their ways in the wilderness. And when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land to them by allotment. After that, he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. And afterward, they asked for a king, so God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. Now, just going to take those for just a moment here. Well, let me get verse 22 also. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. When he asked them, do you have anything to say? And Saul begins to speak. in my mind, it reminded me a little of Luke, the fourth chapter. You remember Jesus going into the synagogue at Nazareth? And the one difference there is Jesus actually did the reading. He read from the prophets. He read from Isaiah 61. You remember he stood up and he read that. And then he sat down and he announced, "Now it's fulfilled in your hearing." Paul and Barnabas don't get the opportunity to do the reading, but he said, "Do you have anything to say?" And Paul, motioning with his hand, Luke will note three different times about Paul motioning with his hand. He'll say it again at the end of chapter 21 when he's standing on the stairs, you know, and he's going to speak to that crowd, motioning with his hands. Acts 26, when he speaks to Agrippa, he will take note of that hand motion. I don't know what the motion exactly was, but it, to me, it's striking that three times he says this. And he opens up with, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God." You know, I think we're talking Jews, and you Gentiles who are here as people who respect God. Listen, as I noted in number 10, both Paul and Stephen, you know, at first glance, it's easy to say they took a similar approach. Stephen, you know, he's going through this history of Israel. Paul is going to take us with this history of Israel. But their approaches couldn't be much, you know, more different. You remember Stephen, you know, he takes them back to Abraham. And what he does as he goes through their history is point out time and time again, they rejected God's chosen leader. He pointed out, I think there's an emphasis in chapter 7, there is holy land outside Jerusalem. God's not bound to the temple. When Paul does their history, it's nothing like that. In fact, all he wants to do is get to Jesus, the seed of David. And it appears to me that pretty much the first part of it, it's just kind of establishing a common ground. Hey, this is our history. This is your history. It's my history. There's not any of the failures of the people like Stephen was doing. It was a different, the situation was different. You know, we sometimes may give different emphasis to the same, you know, you look at the same passage and it's not like it says two different things. I don't mean that. But sometimes I may emphasize one point, and another time I emphasize something else. So he says, listen. And verse 17, "The God of this people Israel chose our fathers." Again, you remember Stephen starts out talking about the call of Abraham. He talks about the fathers envying Joseph and selling him into slavery. Here, Paul just jumps straight to Egypt. In the Exodus. He chose our fathers. That's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. But there's no dwelling on that. He brought them out of the land of Egypt with an uplifted arm. He emphasized, here is God providing for Israel. And for 40 years, he put up with their ways in the wilderness. Again, here's that suggestion of their evil, isn't it? And yet, he's not stressing, oh, those wicked people. It's God. God put up with them. In fact, some translations say he carried them for 40 years in the wilderness. God destroyed seven nations. God gave them their land. What he's leading to is God gave them Jesus. You know, and that's going to be that step in this. Stephen was, "You rebelled, you rebelled, you rebelled." Paul is, "God gave you," God gave, you know, you being Israel, he being part of, "God gave us," you know, "He led us with a strong arm out of Egypt. He put up with us in the wilderness. He destroyed the nations. He gave us the land. He gave us judges." You know, if you were to go to the book of Judges, why did they end up having to have judges? Well, they didn't have a king, but when would a judge usually rise up? When they were in trouble because they had fallen away. But what, you look at it here, any reference to the falling away? No, he just gave them judges. And it says he gave them judges for about 450 years. The English Standard translates that this way. It said, all of this took about 450 years, and after that he gave them judges. It makes the 450 years apply to the wilderness, the conquest, the time in Egypt. And that seems to fit just a little bit better. But that's not what's critical. Look at what he does next. And afterward they ask for a king. So God gave them Saul. Now, you go back. 1 Samuel 8. They ask for a king. And what's the reason they gave for wanting a king? Everybody else has a king. We need a king to judge us, to fight our wars. Why did they think they needed a king to fight their wars? Because they weren't listening to God. The reason they've been suffering through the period of the judges is because of disobedience. You know, one of my little mantras is God's plan works when we work God's plan. They thought God's plan was failing because they weren't working God's plan. Does Paul make mention of they asked for a king in rebellion? No, they asked for a king and God gave them a king. Who did he give them? Saul from what tribe? Benjamin. Do you think when Paul would say that, there was maybe just a little smile on his face? His name was Saul. What tribe was he from? Benjamin. Or was it one of those? You know, we were always one of the smallest tribes. Our moment of glory turned into Saul. I don't know what but I think, he makes specific mention. This was Saul, son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin for 40 years. By the way, the 40 years is never mentioned in 1 Samuel. That's a detail we pick up here. So, but notice this theme of God doing for them. God giving them. God protecting them. God granting them the land. He gave them a king. Yep. We could look at all the problems that came up. That's not what he looks at. And then, when he had removed him, Saul was disobedient. When he had removed him, he raised up for them David, a good king, a man after his own heart. There's this emphasis, he gave. Now, when you come to the story of David, you've got about 600 more years of Old Testament history, plus another 400 years to get to Christ. Does Paul talk about any of that? No. He jumps. He has laid enough groundwork that he's ready to go to the main point. Now, before I go to the main point, does anybody have anything they want to add, or maybe there's something that needs to be subtracted from what I've said thus far? I don't want to rush it. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it is interesting. That uplifted arm, that, was a, some might say a strong arm, which, maybe Luke in the book of Acts, there are just little things that I don't know their great value, but yet they're interesting to notice. One of them, I'll just give you a little preview of chapter 15, when the men come up to Antioch. It will say in verse 2, Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute. Luke has a style of when he wants to say something was big, he will say it was not little. It was not a small dissension. He will say of Philippi, it was no insignificant city. Instead of saying it was a great city, he will say it wasn't insignificant. And there are several places he will do that. What's the value of that? but it's just a literary thing you pick up on, you know, worth looking at. Or anybody else? All right, let's look at 22 through 28. I'm going to back it up again and get David in. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart who will do all my will. From this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. After John had first preached before his coming, the baptism of repentance to all the people of Israel. And as John was finishing his course, he said, Who do you think that I am? I am not he, but behold, there comes one after me, the sandals of whose feet I am not worthy to loose. Men and brethren, sons of the family of Abraham, and those among you who fear God, to you the word of this salvation has been sent. For those who dwell in Jerusalem and their rulers, because they did not know him, nor even the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath, have fulfilled them in condemning him. And though they found no cause for death in him, they asked Pilate that he should be put to death. He just jumps. God gave you. You know, God delivered. God carried you. God gave you the judges. God gave you the land. God gave you Saul. God gave you the good King David. And then from David, he gave you a Savior. He jumps to that great point. And he says, verse 23, I want you to kind of notice a theme of emphasis. From this man's seed, according to the promise. Verse 27, all the prophets, or the voices of the prophets, he mentions. Then in verse 29, when they had fulfilled all that was written concerning him. Verse 32, that promise which was made to the fathers. This is a Jewish audience. Even those that fear God are people who are attending the synagogue every Sabbath. And he wants to drive home, I know I'm telling you something that's new to you. You've not been a people that believe in Jesus. But I want you to see that what God gave us, the God who gave us the Exodus and who carried us through the wilderness, the God who gave us the land, who gave us the judges, who gave us the kings. You remember, he made some promises. He promised things through his prophets. And that's what this Jesus is. He's the fulfillment of all of that. That just keeps driving home the promise, fulfillment. I find verse 24 interesting to me. How that he turns to John the Baptist. You know, and think back to the sermons we've seen thus far. Do you remember Acts 2, Acts 3, even Acts 7 if we want to count Stephen's, talking about John the Baptist? It was kind of a new twist here. You know, this is something a little different in this one. Why does he bring up John the Baptist? Well, I mean, other than to tell us what John said, when John was alive, do you remember what it said the people, how the people regarded him? They said he's a prophet. That's right. And in fact, when Jesus began to work miracles, his ministry was growing, do you remember what some people said? This is John the Baptist come back from the dead. John had a lot of notoriety. Do you think in the years since that, word's not spread? Remember, the Jewish people, you know, maybe not every year, but regular trips were made to Jerusalem for Passover, Pentecost, other feasts. People there, they would have heard about John the Baptist teaching and heard about this prophet that was beheaded by Herod. You know, what happened with all of that? And he said, John preached before his coming that baptism of repentance. But he said, I'll tell you, before John was finished up, while he was finishing his course, you know, of course, John's course didn't finish up just, you know, he got old and retired. He got thrown into the prison. He tells him, do you know what John said? John said, I'm not the one. There's one coming after me who's greater than me. You know, you just have to, the more you think about John the Baptist, I think the more you have to admire that man. I mean, that courage. The courage that he would say to Herod what needed to be said. You know, and all the things. But the humility. I mean, when you've got the statements made in Mark 1:5 that all Judea went out to him to be baptized. And I know that's somewhat hyperbole. But it's saying the crowds were huge. Could I keep my feet on the ground if, you know, suddenly, you know, word began to spread and, next Sunday, you know, there were 25, 30 visitors said, we've heard about your preaching. And the next week, there were another 50. And pretty soon, you know, we're trying to figure out how are we going to get everybody in here because they've come to hear you preach. You know, would it go to my head? You know, I would hope not, but that kind of thing ruins people. Not John. You know, now that's not the main point, and I don't want you to think it is. I just think it's worth noting that here is a man who remained humble. But he said he was pointing to somebody else. Well, let me tell you who he's pointing to. Look at verse 26. Men and brethren, sons of the family of Abraham, and those among you who fear God. This speech, to this point, I mean, everything is just as conciliatory as it can be. He's trying, as far as he knows, he's got open-minded people. And he's appealing to them, you know, by calling out, you know, he'd started it off, men of Israel, you who fear God. He comes back to it. You sons of Abraham. You who fear God, he said, this word, the word of this salvation has been sent. God is giving. It's that theme again. He's giving. He's giving to you. Now, he's not going to dispute that Jesus died a most disgraceful death. Verse 29, he was killed on the tree. And we know Galatians 3, what about the one that hangs on a tree? He's cursed. We saw that in Acts 5. But he says, here's why he was killed. Verse 27. Here's one of those big differences between the sermon of Acts 2, sermon of Acts 3. In Acts 2, Peter said, whom did Peter say killed Christ? You did it. Well, he's a long ways from Jerusalem. He said, the rulers there did it. Why did they do it? They didn't know Jesus, and what else did they not know? The voice of the prophets, which are what? Read every Sabbath. If I could just step aside from, and I don't want to lose the thread of this speech, but what he says here is the kind of thing that ought to be sobering to us. Here are people, he said, they heard the prophets every Sabbath. They didn't kill the Christ because, well, they'd never been exposed to Isaiah 53. They had never heard the prophecy of Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. It wasn't because they had never heard Isaiah 40. And I know they didn't have the chapters. They'd heard all those things every Sabbath. And it just went right by them. They didn't apply it. I have to look at myself. You have to look at yourself and realize we can hear it and not hear it. That ought to be a warning to us. But he says of them, They heard it, but they didn't do it. And he said there was no real cause of death. So what did they do? They put him to death. They asked Pilate that he'd be put to death. Verse 29, now when they had fulfilled all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead. There are several places in the Bible where those words, but God, what words they are. Ephesians 2, you were dead in trespasses, sins, and he goes on and on and he says, but God, who is rich in mercy, intervened. They killed him. And they fulfilled. And it may well be, you know, if we had the full sermon recorded, he may have cited some passages. It may well have given them some prophecies that were fulfilled. But he said, they took him down, they laid him in a tomb, but God raised him from the dead. God overturned the verdict. And can you just imagine these people? That when Paul started the speech, we've heard that history many times. We love that story. You know, the Exodus, we tell that every Passover. We've heard these stories read many times. And then he begins to talk about Jesus. We've heard about him. We heard kind of a rabble rouser. He was put to death. And what does Paul do? Paul doesn't deny he was put to death. But Paul said he was raised. And then he says he was seen for many days. By whom? Those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are his witnesses to the people. Do you find it? You notice that Paul doesn't here cite himself as a witness? He cites those men who were with him. We talk about Cornelius. He spoke of how at Cornelius' house, Peter said, witnesses specially chosen. James and John and Philip and Thomas and Peter, Andrew, these men who've been with him for 3 years, when they sat there by the Sea of Galilee and they ate that fish with him, when Thomas put his hand in the nail prints, these are men that were in a position to know, is this a hoax? Is this a pretender? You know, if he had appeared to just anybody, and I mean, he was seen by others, but these are the witnesses that could know, that could bear this testimony. He said that there's evidence. And I suspect, and this is only a suspicion, but I think it's obvious that this is not the full every word that was spoken that day recorded, that he may have told about the road to Emmaus. He could have told about that fishing trip at the Sea of Galilee, Thomas, all these other things. But he said, I've got some good news for you. We declare to you glad tidings, that promise which was made to the fathers. God has fulfilled this for us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus. And now he's going to cite three passages. As it is also written in the second Psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And that he raised him from the dead, no more to return to corruption, he has spoken thus, I will give you the sure mercies of David. Therefore he also says in another Psalm, you will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. For David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell asleep, was buried with his fathers and saw corruption, but he whom God raised up saw no corruption. You might notice how the very end of that is so much like Acts 2. Same passage cited, much like the argument on Pentecost. But the second Psalm, does anybody remember where in Acts we saw the second Psalm quoted earlier? It wasn't in the context of the resurrection. I'll give you a hint. It was between chapters 3 and 5. End of chapter 4, when Peter and John have been threatened. and they went back, it said, to their own company, and they prayed. They prayed the words of Psalm 2. Look there real quickly at Psalm 2. It's right after Psalm 1, those of you looking for it. Psalm 2 opened up, why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth, you know, set themselves. And it says in verse 4, he who sits in the heavens shall laugh. In Acts 4, they looked at the first part of this, the futility of those that would rise up against the Lord's anointed. At the end of this, though, verse 7, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Jesus was never begotten in a literal physical sense by God. Yes, he was miraculously placed into the womb of Mary. But what Paul is saying in Acts 13, he's applying this to the resurrection, to the glorification of Jesus. Yet Jesus was the Son of God while on earth. This is my beloved Son. But when resurrected, remember what Romans 1 says? Declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. That this is that momentous thing, and I might give you the end of this psalm. And I suspect there were many in that crowd that knew it. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him. He doesn't cite that part of the psalm. But I suspect there were many that knew that psalm didn't just say, you are my son. It said, you give homage to the Son or you perish. But he moves on from that. He moves to Isaiah 55. I love Isaiah 55, don't you? One of those beautiful passages that talks about how he will give us wine and milk without money, without price. It's the passage, the chapter, seek the Lord while he may be found. In verse 3, incline your ear and come to me, hear and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, the sure mercies of David. I think what is being said in Acts 13 is, y'all know, and I know Paul used the word y'all, I'm sure he did. You know, he said, y'all know that Isaiah was living 300 years after the death of David. And Isaiah was promising the mercies of David. He was promising to bless the people. That wasn't in David himself. That's in the seed of David. And the mercies of God, the everlasting covenant, is in Jesus Christ. That's where it's to be found. Isaiah 55, what a wonderful chapter that is. But in it, going back one more, he quotes Psalm 16. Kevin, you can pick it up right there with verse 35. All right, Lord willing, I will be in Noon in Sharpsburg, Georgia, Sunday. Janet and I will be there, and Kevin will finish up Acts. Hopefully, I don't know how far he'll go. Maybe he'll do better than me. All right. Yeah.